You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Thursday, February 23rd, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar, and this is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, another one of my famous vacation shows. Why are my vacation shows famous? Because they're probably even better than my non-vacation shows. I should be going on vacation the whole year. Maybe just come back and actually, like, 3 weeks out of the year, do live shows and be on vacation the entire time. That's how good our vacation content is. Ladies and gentlemen, can you name for me another show that when they go on vacation, it's just as good, if not better, than when they don't? I think I've stumbled on something here. I've got two theories. One, we all need a four-day week, a weekend. Maybe 3 days. But I could go to four. Probably three. And two, the majority of the year, vacation. Maybe 3-4 weeks of working. Sort of just the reverse of Europe. You know? Because the Europeans, we're that much better than Europe. That's what I'm saying. Europe, they go on vacation 3-4 weeks. Well, you know what I say? We go on vacation for 48 weeks. So today on the program, all new content for you, even though I'm on vacation. Just because I'm sitting around with my daughter yelling at me about something or making me clean up after her drawing, or she glitter bombed me and I've got to clean that up, doesn't mean that you don't get new material. Today on the program, the great Lawrence Lessig. He has written a new, I don't know what you call this. They call them Kindle singles now. It's like a tiny book. And you can get it on Amazon. It's called One Way Forward, The Outsider's Guide to Fixing the Republic. As you know, Lawrence Lessig, he's one of the creators of the Creative Commons copyright. About 4 years ago, I think it was, he decided to tackle our broken government, and he's been working on it ever since. This dovetails nicely with the interview that we did with John Sarbanes yesterday, or I guess Tuesday, about how we can really take back our elections, not from an ideological standpoint, but really basically just from an outsider versus insider standpoint. I know you're going to enjoy that interview. And then later in the program, longtime listeners know that Just Coffee was our first sponsor. It's also our only sponsor. And it was also during Break Room Live. He was Mark Maron's. I mean, Just Coffee was Mark Maron's first sponsor. There's a reason. One, there's very few companies that I feel comfortable endorsing because of a myriad of reasons. Some are political, some are social, I got into an argument with the guy who runs the company. And, you know, one time he called me fat. Just Coffee is a great company. And the other reason is, frankly, to be totally honest, I get some free coffee out of the deal. And their coffee is excellent. And so, the old saying, feed me coffee and I will have you sponsor my show. And so we talked to them about fair trade, about the way they do their co-op, which is actually sort of interesting in the context of Occupy Wall Street, the idea of sort of, you know, can you function as a organization without much hierarchy? So we talk about that. We talk about fair trade. And so you stick around. It's Matt Early, one of the founders of JustCoffee.coop. And tomorrow on the program, it's Casual Friday, but it's anything but. We'll be talking to Derek Jensen, who's actually, you know, a casual guy. But his ideas are a little bit less than casual. He is a philosopher. He's an author. And he's a radical environmentalist. And he was quoted in Chris Hedges' piece on the Black Bloc. Interesting guy. Interesting interview. I know you're going to enjoy that as well. So enjoy what we have for you today. And enjoy what we have for you tomorrow. And, of course, I will be back live on Monday unless I have somehow seriously been injured by my family. So, Professor, one way forward. Tell me this ultimately comes down for you in terms of our political system. And I should say also you have been tell me essentially the main message of One Way Forward.
Well, so the world, meaning political pundits, divide American politics into the left side versus the right side. And I think the most important division today is not so much the left side versus the right side as it is the inside versus the outside. And what we've seen over the past, I think, decade, as I describe in the book, is wave after wave of this kind of grassroots outsider political movement that are not, you know, politician wannabes or people who are like finding another way into becoming congressmen or senators or presidents, but instead people who have just, for various reasons, grown increasingly disgusted or outraged or frustrated with their government and are, you know, taking it upon themselves to do something to change it. And I think we're in one of these really critical moments right now with these outsider movements. Obviously the Occupy movement is one part of it. But I also, in the book, try to argue that I think the Tea Party, the grassroots part of the Tea Party, is another one of these movements. And I think the opportunity right now is for these very different movements with very different values to recognize that, in fact, though they don't have a common end, they have a common enemy. And the common enemy is the corruption of this government by the corrupting influence of money inside of politics, and that blocks the left and the right from getting what they want from our government, and that we have an opportunity to work, you know, across these partisan divisions to force change in this government that might end that corrupting influence.
Now, you started, I guess it was now about 4-5 years ago, after sort of spending 10 years of your career focusing on copyright issues and developing basically a new form of copyright. You set out to sort of figure out how to fix what was wrong with our government. At what point in this process, and maybe it was just at the beginning, did you come to this to see what was broken in the context of our government to be an insider versus outsider split?
Well, I think that, you know, the work I did with copyright and the internet was the first demonstration of that. You know, I started working in that field probably about 12 or 14 years ago and became something of an activist as I saw you know, I really was a lawyer with a guilty conscience as I saw the law grow in ways that was really destructive to the internet and really to the traditions of copyright law. And as, you know, I and many others were pushing for people to recognize the need not to abolish copyright, but to update it to a digital age, we saw that, you know, parents and businesses and educators and, you know, all the ordinary people out there were understanding the need and recognizing and agreeing that there needed to be this kind of update. But policymakers, you know, Congress, were making no progress at all. Indeed, you know, you would talk to them and they wouldn't even recognize that there was another side to the issue. They just had heard only one side of the issue, and they'd heard only one side for the obvious reason that, you know, the public domain didn't have a lobbyist and wasn't going to get a lobbyist or wasn't going to be channeling millions of dollars in campaign funds into the system. And so, therefore, that side was just absent from the debate. It didn't lose the debate. It just was absent from the debate. And it began to make, you know, a kind of obvious point inescapable, which was we weren't going to make any progress on this esoteric issue of copyright, and not just esoteric issues like copyright, you know, fundamental issues like global warming or environmental issues or real healthcare issues, or even for people on the right, simpler taxes or smaller government. We're going to make no progress on any of those issues so long as we had this corrupt system governing the process in Washington. So it was that recognition that, you know, actually outsiders from the political system were pretty good at figuring this stuff out, and the insiders were systematically blocked, that led me to say we had to figure a way to fix that ultimate corruption.
So, you know, one of the troubles, I mean, let's, you know, for the sake of argument, I mean, I'm a little more skeptical of the Tea Party, perhaps, than you are. But for the sake of the argument, let's accept the premise that we're looking at, you know, different grassroots here, because I do think I do tend to agree with you that the primary issue of our day is this notion of insiders versus outsiders. But how do you bridge this notion of, like, even when you talk about it in terms of how you came to sort of see the dysfunction in our government in the concept of issues of, like, public domain, of how do you bridge this gap in terms of when you talk about solutions to empower people over the big money institutions, they necessarily require some type of activism coming from the collective. In other words, it may be regulation, or maybe there's other solutions that you can talk to that don't necessarily conflict with some of the agendas, let's say, on the right. This is one of the sort of the sticking points that I always sort of bump up against. Does that make sense?
Yeah, they don't conflict. I think that the you know, the insight is that we've got to find a way to exert power on the structures of our government. Not, you know, I think one of the mistakes the Tea Party made was so quickly trying to become kind of insiders inside of Washington. And it's led to, you know, a weakening of their movement, because I think, you know, that splits the movement, and half of them are in favor of what the Republicans are doing. The other half is disgusted. I think the key is that we got to recognize that it's the system itself that has become corrupted. It's not because we've got too many Rob Blagojeviches in Washington. Indeed, I think in that sense of corruption, you know, we've got the cleanest Congress in the history of Congress. They're not filled with people committing criminal acts. What instead they're filled with is people who are inside a system where they can't help but focus their attention on the interest of those who fund their campaigns. And the people who fund their campaigns are the tiniest fraction of the 1%, right? So 0.26% of Americans give more than $200 in a congressional campaign. 0.05% give a maximum amount to any candidate. 0.01%, the 1% of the 1%, give more than $10,000 in an election cycle. So in a system where they're so obsessed with what this tiny slice of the 1% wants, they are drawn away from what America wants, and we have to recognize that as America and you know, break them of this dependency. You know, they need an intervention. We need to intervene and take the bottle away and get them to focus again on what they're supposed to focus on.
Is this sort of problem that we have? I mean, there's plenty of studies to show. I think the most prominent of which comes out of Princeton, which shows that over the past 30 years, whenever there's a policy conflict, it does not break down on partisan lines or left and right lines or party lines. It is always the policy. If there's a policy preference difference between essentially moneyed interest and people in general, it always falls in favor of the moneyed interest. Is this a really sort of just a reemergence of a battle between people and the establishment? I mean, is this a new phenomenon, or is it one that we've been dealing with maybe for 40, 45 years?
Well, it comes in cycles. I think an interesting referent point is 1912, when the progressive movement, which was not a bunch of liberals, it was, people from all political stripes who called themselves progressive. And in the 1912 election, there were two candidates who called themselves progressives, and between the two of them, they garnered 70% of the vote of the American people. So I think that we've been fighting this kind of issue again and again over our history, but it changes, it morphs into something different. So 100 years ago, the kind of corruption they were fighting was the corruption of bribery, crass quid pro quo bribery. And I think the corruption we're seeing now has nothing to do with that kind of crass bribery. It's just as effective. Indeed, I think it's even more destructive. But it's not people violating the law. And so I think that this version of corruption actually is it's at its acute form only relatively recently. I think it's actually just after Gingrich took over as Speaker and Congress radically changed its way of behaving and shifted into this full-time war mode of constant fundraising, constant battle to retake control in the next election, that we began to see Congress become something very different from what it was originally. But there's no doubt that we've been fighting issues like this since time immemorial. We just have to fight it in new and different forms.
Okay, we're talking to Professor Lawrence Lessig about his new book, One Way Forward. When we come back, let's talk more about what steps can be taken to further identify the common enemy, and then what's the next step after that, and how can that step following the identification of what the real problem is, how do you implement those policies, particularly across ideological lines? We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. This is a fake break. So, Professor Lessig, we were talking in the first half of before the break about the disparate, theoretically, ideologically different groups in this country who are grassroots oriented, who see that one of the biggest problems that we have in this country is more of an insiders versus outsiders versus insiders problem, rather than any ideological differences that we have in terms of sort of subsidiary issues, that we have a structural problem in this country. Mm-hmm. Once that's identified, is that where, once there's broader acceptance of that, and to a certain extent there is pretty broad acceptance of it, how do you fix these things, both from the challenges that exist procedurally and the challenges that are brought up by having disparate ideologies want to apply their ideological fixes for this?
Yeah. So first we got to identify what the fix is. And in my view, the fix is recognizing that the only way to reform a system where Congress is dependent on the funders, but the funders are not the people. The only way to reform that system is to make it so the funders are the people, so that when they're responsive to the funders, they're responsive to us. And the way to do that is to adopt a kind of small-dollar, citizen-funded model for elections, where, in my version that I describe, everybody gets the first $50 of tax revenue that they pay to the government sent back to them in the form of a democracy voucher. And with that voucher, they can give it to any member of Congress or candidate for Congress who agrees to fund his or her campaign with vouchers only, plus contributions of citizens of up to $100. So So that would fund an election system. Actually, that amount of money is three times the total amount that was spent in 2010. That would fund an election system where the money didn't come from the top 1% or the top fraction of 1%. It would be coming from all of us. And so that when Congress did something stupid, it was not because they were bought. It was because they just did the wrong thing, and we'd have a democratic reason to respond. That's what I think we got to be aiming for, plus changes to the Supreme Court's crazy Citizens United decision. But then the question is, so what is it that would bring about that kind of change? Because the biggest block here is not, you know, identifying the problem or figuring out what a solution to the problem looks like. The biggest block is figuring out a way to put enough pressure on that institution to get it to do the right thing. And that's why I think the outsiders movements that I'm talking about have got to begin to up the ante and talk about the fundamental constitutional authority in this nation to guide and direct the government to do what the government should be doing. If we can get people to focus on establishing rules for this game that we can trust and bracketing for the moment very important differences between the left and the right. You know, I consider myself from the left. I have very important views about egalitarian tax policies, about human rights, about, you know, healthcare, global warming. These are issues that are very important to me. But I think we have to finally recognize neither side's going to get anything we're fighting for until we address this fundamental problem first. And we need a strategy for doing that.
And the proposal where it's almost a there seems to be in this proposal, in the embedded in the proposal you just discussed, not enough government restriction to offend the sensibilities of the constitutional sensibilities, sensibilities about overreach by government, sensibilities about the role of money as speech, but it's a combination of essentially just asking the government just off of the vouchers, and then it's about public shame in some respects.
Yeah, you offer the vouchers, you give Congress people and candidates a reason to use them, and then if they don't opt into using them, you shame them. You know, so when Connecticut adopted a similar program, not exactly what I've described, but a similar small dollar funded election system, in the first year of that system, 78% of elected representatives used the small dollar funded system, Republicans and Democrats alike, because it just made sense. It made sense because it was easier for them to fund their campaigns. They wouldn't spend as much time raising money, and because they didn't want to be known as the person who was taking money from the special interest as opposed to taking money from everybody inside in the state. So I think we need to, you know, if we created that alternative, we would create enormous opportunity for people in Congress and running for Congress to do the right thing, and then we'd create a reason for people like us to begin to believe in what they did again, as opposed to, as most of us believe, having a cynical assumption whenever we see them doing something that we don't like.
Well, Professor Lawrence Lessig, thanks so much for your time today. The book is One Way Forward, and now it gets back to the pavement to try and push for this type of reform.
Great. I appreciate you having me on. Thanks.
Every day I get up and pray that you're, and he increases the number of clocks by exactly one. Everybody's coming home for lunch these days. Last night there were skinheads on my lawn. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Some people say that bowling alley's got big legs.
Okay, we are back, and it is a pleasure to welcome to the show Matt Early. He is the co-founder and head of farmer relations for JustCoffee.coop, our original sponsor, I mean, not just on the Majority Report, but also back in the day on Break Room Live, and a sponsor of this program. But I wanted to talk to you, Matt, because I wanted an opportunity for our audience to just hear about the about what fair trade is. And also, again, to compliment you guys on your coffee, I love it. I have been drinking it now for, I guess, 3-4 years, and I want to thank you for the sponsorship, but also I appreciate your business.
Wow, thanks a lot, Sam. I appreciate that. Yeah, and we're super happy to still be in partnership with you guys and building that up, and fully support your show and the shows you've done in the past. So yeah, it's a pleasure for us to work with you all and to be here on the Majority Report with you.
All right, so now we've got that full disclosure over. Tell the audience what does fair trade mean?
Man, that's a great question. It's actually a really relevant question for right now. Fair trade as a concept has been around at least 40 or 50 years in the U.S. Kind of came up through church-based groups that were working with artisans in the global South and recognizing the value of the work that they did and trying to create better markets for them here in the U.S. where they could receive a fair wage for the work that they're doing. Over the years, it's become much more complex. And today, what we're looking at is a situation, in our opinion anyway, where there are two very distinct and main currents in fair trade right now. Just Coffee Co-op, we consider ourselves part of what we see as a movement to build a better economic model, a model of social and economic justice and economic democracy, and trying to include both the coffee farmers who we work with in that project and also the end consumers of the coffee that we roast. So we see it as a way to sort of tear down those barriers that separate us in the marketplace and let us, create a way for us all to be able to see each other and to appreciate each other and to work with each other as partners from the beginning of that chain to the end. But there's another very powerful sort of piece of fair trade these days, and I would call that the more market-based piece of fair trade. And it is sort of revolves around certification agencies and building a brand and working with large corporations like Starbucks and Green Mountain coffee companies and others to build a brand and promote that brand, in our opinion, at the peril of the movement piece of it. So dumbing down standards, dumbing down the education piece for consumers. The latest big thing in the coffee industry with fair trade is a movement to allow plantations into the fair trade system, which has always been a way to highlight and create a market for small farmers and their cooperatives. Again, economic democracy. So there's a lot of, I don't know if I'd call it conflict, but disagreement and discussion going on within fair trade these days, and a lot of struggle over defining what that movement is and how to move forward the best way.
So, I mean, at the end of it, how is it that, I'm not making a sales pitch here, but your prices are completely consistent with what it would cost me to go and buy, a bag of beans at a Starbucks, or in many cases it's even less expensive. How is it that you guys manage to pay the suppliers, the farmers of your coffee, a fair wage, and still sort of deliver it to the consumer at a price that's consistent with everybody else's price?
Well, I mean, I think the short answer to that is that our model isn't a solely profit motivated model of business, where some of the companies that you just mentioned, like Starbucks or other more, I would say, traditional coffee roasting enterprises, their mission is to turn a profit, either for the smaller private roasters or for their shareholders, for the bigger ones. For us, profit as a for-profit business, and that's what we are technically, we do have to make a bit of a profit just to continue doing what we do and to be able to grow. But profit is not our main objective. what our main objective is building sort of this movement and this model of economic and social justice. And we feel like a big part of that is, economic, it's sort of redistribution of wealth. So we do try to pay as much as we can to growers, and we've been sort of on the leading edge of that for several years now. But also, people at Just Coffee aren't breaking the bank. Nobody here is getting wealthy. And when we started the business, that was sort of a defined, it's something that we realized that we wouldn't do that. But we also realized if we could make enough to sort of feed our families and to keep going, that's what we needed to do. And we were willing to do that. So I think that for us, part of being a fair trade model is not only paying the farmers a fair wage or trying to pay them a fair wage, but it's also being able to give the end consumer a fairly priced product. So that's what we do.
It's coffee. It seems to me that that fair trade is most often associated with coffee. Is that? Am I just perceiving it that way because I've been in business with you guys, or is that the case? Because I just don't see the concept of fair trade in other products in the same way. Apple obviously is in the news these days, now they've agreed at least to provide or to have their suppliers audited for standards and practices in terms of the way they treat their workers. But, they're certainly not, you don't hear much about fair trade electronics. Why do we hear about it more in terms of coffee?
Well, coffee was sort of the first, other than the smaller artisan stuff that was going on before coffee was the first global commodity that was introduced into a fair trade system and that had a fair trade system constructed around it. There are other commodities. There's tea, there's honey, there's sugar, there's wine now, there's flowers. There are a lot of things that are fair trade certified, quote unquote, which I think, in some products has more validity than others. For instance, in tea and in fruit, bananas in particular, plantations have been part of that a fair trade paradigm for a while. And that's been, fairly controversial. But with coffee, I think, coffee not only is it one of the sort of most traded commodities in the world, it also really lends itself to our relationships and stories, and it's such an intimate part of so many people's lives. I think it's been a really easy product to build a fair trade system around and to be able to tell that story and get people to really envision where that coffee is coming from and who it is that's growing that coffee. And so I think that's probably, one of the main reasons why coffee has been sort of at the forefront of this. As far as electronics go, there are a lot of, there's a lot of products out there. It's really difficult when you look at electronics and a lot of others. That's a really complex commodity chain, and coffee is a very straightforward commodity chain. Someone grows it, it's processed, it's shipped, it's roasted, and it's sold. With electronics, you have things coming from all over, and there's contractors and subcontractors, and it's kind of like apparel in that way, which is another complex commodity chain. So, but one of the things I think that what Fairtrade has done, with coffee is sort of being the headliner, but with other products is that we're not only trying to build a brand like the more sort of corporate fair trade model I think would have us do, but we're also educating people to sort of think beyond that 7 seconds they spend choosing a product in the grocery store and looking at everything they buy and thinking, where does this come from? How is it made? How are people affected by my consumer decision? And I think we're seeing that in what's going on with Apple, this week and other things where people are saying, wait a second, what is the meaning of this iPhone that I'm holding in my hand and how has this affected people negatively or positively? So I think that's one of the great successes of the fair trade movement is to try to get people to ask those questions with every single thing they purchase And that's really powerful. You know, we can do that and we can make a huge difference, I think, if we're willing to do that with everything that we buy.
And let's just talk briefly about Just Coffee in particular. It's a co-op. I mean, aside from the fact that I also got to say, like, you know, your site is justcoffee.coop is, if anybody's really interested on just sort of seeing how the whole process works, you guys have a whole transparency section of the site where you can see how much you guys pay per pound for the coffee. You have a map of your the supply chains for the coffee presumably the tea and the chocolate as well. But you guys are also a co-op. How does that work?
It works. It's kind of clunky sometimes, but it works really well. I mean, democracy is a messy process, as you know, and you know, with we're a worker cooperative, so the people that work at the business are also the people that own the business, and the majority of people working at Just Coffee are also owners. So you know, it's been an incredible sort of process for us to even figure out over the years what a co-op is and how it needs to be run effectively. You know, to have a successful business, and also how it changes as your business changes and grows. But you know, it's always the underpinnings of it is democracy in the workplace, and the people who own the business are also the people who are there in the trenches working every day. And we feel like what that does is, you know, it gives people every minute they're bagging coffee or trying to collect money from people. You know, it gives you that incentive to really always want to do your best, you know, especially when you have a sort of a social and political mission behind your business. It's motivating to us, and, you know, it lets us see that everybody here is equal. For us, it's the best organizational and ownership model that you could have in a business, because, you know, the people here are the people who have stake in it.
Do you have, I assume, some type of hierarchical structure, or do you? I mean, how do you guys decide? We're gonna put out a new type of coffee. We're, you know, let's do some Bolivian or let's do Ethiopian. Right. How granular is the sort of the democratization of every decision?
You know, it's part of our process has been learning the difference between a collective management style and a cooperative ownership model. So everything we used to do when we were smaller, our joke was we weren't allowed to tie our shoes without taking a vote from everybody who worked at Just Coffee. And actually, when it was really small, that worked great. We all literally were in the same room. We all wore every hat. Everybody roasted.
Everybody wore loafers.
Everybody wore loafers, if we wore shoes at all. As we grew and, you know, as jobs got a little bit more, you know, technical, we've had to stratify, and then we took more people on, and sort of this organic management structure started to grow up. And we really hit a spot last year where we were sort of at the precipice of, you know, we needed to develop a new model and understand what we were doing a little bit better, but didn't really have the tools to do it. None of us are business people. I mean, we are. We call ourselves reluctant business people. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we had no training. Nobody here has really ever taken a business class ever. So figuring out how to go from that collective management style, which really wasn't working anymore, to something that was, you know, a little bit more structured. We really still, like, we shun the term hierarchical, but, you know, you can look at it and there are people who, you know, there's a production manager and there's someone who's in charge now of accounts and financing. And, you know, I manage a couple of people now. And so it was a struggle. We had to call the consultants in and everybody had to just, you know, sit down, and it took us about 6 months and we're still going through it. You know, we've always had at the sort of the bottom of everything is the attention to that democracy in the workplace. And we still, you know, it's still a very democratic process. It's just not as collective as it used to be, with every single person being involved in every decision. So it's definitely still a learning process, but we value it and think it's the best way to go.
Well, Matt Early, I appreciate the support that you guys have given me and the shows that I've been a part of over the years. And frankly, I genuinely love your coffee, which is why we've been able to maintain this relationship for so long, because I only drink just coffee, and so it's been a pleasure. And I wish there were more companies out there like you guys, because you are the guys I would love to. It's companies like yours that I really sort of feel comfortable promoting. And I appreciate it. And folks, justcoffee.coop, I got to remind you, 10% discount when you use the coupon code majority. And I also want to tell you guys that I appreciate what you did. You guys are located in Madison. And of course, when all that went down, you were helping people out with coffee when they were heading to the Capitol. And so thanks for all the work you do.
Oh yeah, man, it's our pleasure. I mean, this is it for us. It's all, work and politics and play and everything is the same. So we're really fortunate to be doing what we do, and we're really fortunate to have partners like you all. So I appreciate it
a lot. Thanks, Matt.